was hailed by Rolling Stone as one of the most significant bands ever to emerge from Australia. He's been on the International Board of Greenpeace. He is president of the Australian Conservation Foundation, despite news rumours that he was ex-president. He is president. And the National Trust has named him as a living treasure. Ladies, I hope he can walk up the steps. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Peter Garrett.
I wish the National Trust hadn't done that. Thanks very much, Don. And thanks for the opportunity to have a yarn to you this afternoon. Some people want to hear stories about Midnight Oil. Some people want to be entertained with tales of derring do on the high seas, opposing the dreaded multinational corporations polluting the planet. Some people would be interested in salacious details of private life for the forthcoming autobiography. Some people would like to know which South Australian rules football team I support. And some people may expect me to make reference, and I will make it in passing, to the passing of a past South Australian Premier, Don Dunstan, who I think would be sorely missed by all Australians. But I regret to say that I'm not going to be dealing with any of those things as I speak to the South Australian Press Club. Thank you for giving me a platform to speak about an issue, I think, of some seriousness. You've asked for remarks about key trends in environment issues at a national and at a state level. As ACF President, let me just tell you a little bit about the Foundation. The Australian Conservation Foundation is a democratic membership-based national conservation organisation. It's been going for over 25 years in Australia. It's the leading national group that works on conservation and environment issues. The campaign range of ACF is pretty wide. It deals with biodiversity, sustainable cities, Asia Pacific and Indigenous issues, river health, and in fact I was here, I think, as one of my first tasks as ACF President in August or September of last year at the mouth of the Murray River, where I held a joint press conference with people from the Professional Fishing Association to lament the very, very sad state of the health of the Murray. ACF's been involved in a whole range of initiatives and campaigns over that period of time, has a proud history of defending the natural interests of our environment, defending our national parks, defending our World Heritage areas, but also providing solutions, policy suggestions to government. We were involved in land care, initiated in conjunction with the National Farmers Federation. We've provided a lot of the intellectual driving force, along with the academic community, for the establishment of ESD, ecologically sustainable development, as an abiding principle for decision making. And we continue in a difficult and sometimes indifferent political environment to make our claim and to talk about the things which we think are important. I thought it might be useful, though, instead of talking about national and state issues, to first talk about the global situation for you. Because we are at a remove in Australia, and sometimes we need that context. And unfortunately, that's the serious part of my address to you, because there's no pleasure given and none taken from reporting to you that across most of the dimensions of environment, atmosphere, water, oceans, forests, we're still experiencing a downward trend. There's no argument about this. We take it as scientific fact. There may be some dissension in small quarters, but most of the community, most of the world community, accept that this is where things are at. Despite the reluctance of the Australian government to take seriously something like global warming, it's apparent that as well as experiencing the hottest years on record now, 7 out of the past 10, there are discernible signs recognised by scientists, the bleaching of our coral reefs, temperature recordings at Antarctica, that climate change is a reality. The recent meeting of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in Buenos Aires saw an extremely radical turnaround. No brownie points for this cameraman. Once the international community was calling the environment groups eco-nuts because they were campaigning on climate change, in Buenos Aires, the companies and the NGOs, the environment groups, were in the same corner together, talking about the same issue. At Kyoto, 2 years earlier, the chief executive officer of BP rang the bells of change, but he was by himself. In Buenos Aires, the table was crowded. Now, the United States President's scientific advisor writes simply, global climate change caused by human activity, and above all by fossil fuel combustion, is both the most dangerous and the most intractable problem that civilization faces. He's not mincing words. Because climate creates the envelope of environmental conditions within which all other conditions and processes that operate to support human well-being exist. Now, this statement isn't the advancing of an ideology, as most members of the coalition parties seem to think, nor is he advancing an anti-jobs agenda, as members on both sides of the House sometimes claim. This is a simple move for us to go past sectional interests, because he's simply pointing out that burning more coal, driving more cars, clearing more bush, tearing down more buildings, buildings which store memory as well as carbon, will cause real impacts, and that there's every good reason to move with caution, but no good reason to continue to do what we know is harmful. Still on the international. When British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook spoke in London recently, he referred to the extinction of plant and animal species having reached such a tempo that it's occurring at 1,000 times the natural rate. He just returned for a trip to Kosovo, and in no way did he want to underemphasise the terrible situation there. But his remarks were, while we deal with the conflicts of today, it's crucial that we keep thinking about the world we want to live in tomorrow. These remarks provide a clear indication of the way world leadership is viewing the urgent problems of Earth's health. And it is across all the spheres of the environment, atmosphere, water, vegetations, rivers. It's an interlocking crisis. It impacts on biodiversity, fish stocks, fertility, human health, international relations. The ACF has argued that there are possible responses to this situation. We say that there are solutions. Some parts of the business community are responding, and they say that there are solutions as well. But what we don't accept is that a business-as-usual, tinkering-at-the-margins approach by government, which we witness in Australia, is anything like sufficient to do the job. Along with the companies like BP that I mentioned earlier, who've transformed themselves from an oil company into an energy company, who are investing up to $1 billion in renewables and solar energy, the industry, by the way, that Australia once led the world in, ACF argues that we need to create the conditions for a sustainable century. And in doing that, have systems in place that reward businesses that innovate, that address sustainability, and that take a market share as a result of doing that. Unfortunately, in Australia, our investment and support rate for investing in renewables and sustainables is some 4 times less than our major trading partners. I just want to share with you ACF's view of the 10 key environment issues for this coming year. We're already well into it. Protecting Australia's coastal marine environments. Saving our national parks and world heritage areas. We see this as a critical environment issue, critical in the national context. No to Jabiluka and no, the uranium mine that is, and no to the threats to the Great Barrier Reef. And our argument is a simple one. The generation of income and employment that this country enjoys from sharing and sensibly and in a moderate fashion preserving its national park infrastructure greatly exceeds in the long term any short-term economic benefits that may be gainsaid by ploughing into those areas. Reforming tax to clean up the air, I'll come back to that. Accelerating greenhouse action, I've referred to greenhouse. Rescuing Australia's forests from failing regional forest agreements. I go to Western Australia tomorrow, where all the political parties, with some exceptions, and a substantial proportion of the Western Australian community, viewing the last small stands of Cowrie and Jarrah gone, are up in arms about the idea that we would publicly subsidise the selling off of what was a public asset, it's the Commonwealth's land, to people who bring such a poor return for it and who cause such dislocation to the environment in the process. Bringing back to life the once mighty Darling and Snowy Rivers, a matter that I know that's dear to your hearts. Don't put it in our backyards. Cessation of uranium mining and radioactive waste dump proposals, including the new Sydney nuclear reactor replacement at Lucas Heights. I'll come back to that too. The proposed federal environment bill, we just simply call it the Back to the Future bill. There are serious problems with that bill. Discussions are still underway with the minister, but we have very real and serious concerns about that bill. But all of these things that I've mentioned are subsets of what we believe is the key goal. That is, advancing Australia's role in building a new global economy, because globalism is here for a new century, but one that is truly environmentally sustainable. ACF believes that Australia needs a new environmental framework, not the one on offer at present, which has comprehensive changes in environment legislation, greater participation in decision-making by the community, more partnership approaches, and the willingness to embed sustainability into decision-making. I want to make an observation. As governments progressively seek to remove their involvement, as they consistently look and remove their involvement in provision of services is what I mean, as they move towards seeing other agencies provide services and deliveries, including the NGO or not-for-profit sector of which ACF is a part, there is a very strong assumption that we'll provide the services but not the advocacy that goes with it. We're prepared to put in context the expression by the Prime Minister that everyone's an environmentalist now. But when we place this comment into a meaningful context, we're either ignored or relegated to the margins of debate, which, needless to say, we don't intend to stay. Let me look at a key aspect of the government's approach, which is extremely timely right now. Tax reform. No mention of the environment in the tax package at all. No mention of the environment in the speeches of either Mr. Beazley or Mr. Howard before the last election. No leadership on environment from those political leaders. Every country that has introduced some form of a GST or a services tax in the OECD nations has used that opportunity to at least marginally reconfigure the tax system so that you penalise polluters and reward people who innovate. This is very basic. We call it ecological tax reform. Not a skerrick of ecological tax reform exists in this package at all. But not only that, of much more greater concern is the partner of the GST, which is the reduction by 25 cents a litre in the diesel fuel rebate. Arguably, to provide benefits for rural communities, the transport industry is already on the record as saying it won't pass on any savings in costs to customers. Whilst we recognise the need for rural communities to be properly compensated for the tyranny of distance in this country, we believe that this particular measure is absolutely inappropriate and wrongly targeted. And along with the AMA, the Doctors Association, and the President of the AMA, I appeared before the GST inquiry to put the case that the cost to the Australian community in terms of health costs and on-costs, because of the likely increase in use of diesel vehicles and the fact that the diesel we're talking about is the dirtiest diesel that we manufacture, should rule this out of court altogether. No response from the government whatsoever. Fortunately, there has been response from the Democrats. From the ALP, we're not sure. Local councils, the mayors, have spoken out about it. Who knows what will happen? It's one of those hypotheticals. It's in the hands of a small single voter from Tasmania. Speaking of hypotheticals, let me address a hypothetical for you now. And I stress it's a hypothetical. You've created a monster. You believed it was a monster that was going to solve all the problems in the world, but really all it did was create more problems. The monster itself is out of control. Your agreements about controlling the monsters that you entered into with all the parties that allowed you to create the monster, you now want to tear up and put in the bottom drawer. They are not seriously believed, these agreements. You cannot prove to anyone that you can keep the monster at bay. In fact, you do not know how to keep the monster at bay, but the monster is dangerous and life-threatening.
What's your solution? Find a pleasant, faraway, remote land where there's a friendly and unsuspecting population who don't know that much about the monster, who have an inadequate knowledge of the monster and its characteristics. Bribe them, employ them, cajole them, entreat them. Introduce, with all the sophistication and resources that the PR industries at your disposal have, appeal finally to their hubris, to their inquiring scientific minds who believe there must be a solution for this monster. Use PR, IR. Then, if all fails, address it as a moral issue, a challenge to the remote and faraway land to accept moral responsibilities to deal with the monster. And then leave it with them, the monster that is, to take care of for all time. This, ladies and gentlemen, is my reading of the South Australian environment's most critical issue at the moment. You've got issues to concern yourself in the Lake Eyre Basin with the Murray. You've got issues of biodiversity. You've got issues of the health of river and of ocean systems. But all South Australians of whatever age, whatever political persuasion, whatever football code they may follow, need to be concerned about the expansion of a discredited, dangerous, uncontrollable, toxic and deadly industry, which is the nuclear industry. Now, explicit support for nuclear by the two political parties in this state, I don't know what the media has done about it, so I'll make no comment, combined with the federal government's determination to expand uranium mining and build a nuclear waste dump here, means that South Australia is in the process of consigning its future to be the radioactive state. Victoria is a state of excitement. New South Wales is the premier state. I'm pretty sure you are the festival state. But the name change is surely inevitable. I'll be serious now. ACF harbours very genuine and real misgivings about the current direction of nuclearisation that South Australia is taking. Let me address some of those issues for you now while I've still got time left. Let us state that nuclear waste, whether as a byproduct of mining or processing, is the longest lasting, most harmful material to living things which exists. Past the governments of today and tomorrow, through the lives of our successors, past contemplation, past 10,000, past 100,000 years, let's remember this stuff will be around. Still hot, still highly dangerous. If it's a waste dump, it will require endless monitoring. The concrete and the glass will have to be renewed unless they themselves will last for 100,000 years. The on-site burial, the standing orders for the bureaucrats or the privatised armies will be required to guard it. If it's a mine, then seeing as we're leaving the waste in the ground under the current methods that are being adopted here in South Australia, then it's a place which can no longer be inhabited or used in any way. Nuclear waste, particularly large quantities of nuclear waste, impose an intolerable burden once buried on future generations who inherit a situation not of their making, unpredictable and uncertain. Does the name Maralinga ring a bell to anybody? Clean up costs, name your price. The threshold of approvals for nuclear ought to be, and in most legislatures now where there is a civil society, so high that public confidence can be completely, beyond reasonable doubt, beyond all probability, be assuaged that there is safety. But the public confidence in these legislatures is absent. It is absent in the United Kingdom. It is absent in the United States. And in all those European countries where nuclear is on the way out, not on the way in. Oh, I'm sorry, it's on the way in here. I forgot. Now, people can read their insurance policies, and they realise that they're not covered by nuclear accidents. They recognise that nuclear things have got a special status in the world. The insurance industry doesn't apply its normal rules of provision and compensation to them. It's exempted itself from nuclear, and neither do governments. Who's providing the indemnity for future impacts on groundwater at Honeymoon or Beverly, for the diminishing of the mound springs at Roxbury, for the likelihood of accident in the transport of nuclear waste, low-level, short-lived intermediate waste, by rail, by road, across the sea, when the reprocessed waste comes back for France and settles here in South Australia? We're deeply concerned that the current expansion of the nuclear industry in this state is happening without adequate or proper public consultation, that environment impact assessments are compromised and preempted by government decisions, and that the duty of care owed to its citizens by government is not being met. The ACF has had a direct involvement with this issue from the beginning. We have undertaken the investigative work necessary to inform you and stimulate a public debate on the expansion of this nuclear industry, in order to place on the public record the following. In relation to Beverley, the ACF was responsible for publicly announcing the mine in May 1997. The Commonwealth order for an EIS at the end of 1996 was not public. ACF was responsible for informing the public of the intended discharge of all the trial mine's liquid waste in January 1998, approved by the South Australian government. ACF announced the leak of 500 litres of radioactive liquid at Beverley and the failure to rehabilitate. And we note the Commonwealth ordered EIS for Beverley saw 1,158 public submissions to the draft EIS opposed this mine and 2 supported it. The mine went ahead. Those people who opposed it were opposed to uranium. The operation of the trial mine for 12 months with the impact on the groundwater, the disposal of the trial mine's liquid waste to groundwater without any rehabilitation plan or any liability for impacts to the proponent. The proponent, General Atomics, couldn't even draw on a map the geographic extent of the Beverley aquifer off their lease area. Then Senator Hill had to twice extend the assessment, brought in a US consultant, Lafferty, to advise on the proposal, its impacts, the level of required environmental information. Then Lafferty rejected the level and the type of the baseline environmental information provided by the proponent as inadequate for an in-situ leaching proposal in the US, and stated that the information available did not substantiate the proponent's assumption that the aquifer was isolated from other near-surface groundwater bodies. That the risk of cross-contamination was due to 2 factors, potential for groundwater interconnection and the existence of contaminated liquid with potential to move off-site. Senator Hill then claimed in an announcement, the Christmas Eve announcement, that there was no environmental reason why the mine should not proceed. However, he sought additional studies in part fulfilment of the consultant's recommendations, which were conducted by the Australian Geological Survey Organisation, not independent of government, bearing a similar organisational relationship to ABARE with the government. ABARE's statistics were the ones used to justify us not increasing our greenhouse gas emissions at Kyoto. And the AGSO assert that the Beverley aquifer can be isolated from other groundwater bodies but can't still draw the geographic extent of the Beverley aquifer off the proponent's lease area. We contend that the Beverley project is setting a precedent to permit a nuclear industry, US style, to do in Australia what it would not be allowed to do in the United States. We contend with the use of commercial acid in situ leaching uranium mining, that's pumping the toxic liquid back into the aquifer, failing to rehabilitate the groundwater, failure to undertake adequate baseline studies, would not be accepted in any other similar jurisdiction. We say this is the first Australian mine in the modern era of its type not required to rehabilitate its impacts. We've now reached the stage where Senator Hill reasons that if any third party, either the ACF, traditional owners, or someone else, cannot demonstrate a competing economic use for this part of the Australian environment, in this case the Beverley Aquifer, then it will be deemed not to be required protection. That the concepts of degrading and rehabilitating environments don't apply because there's no economic value in that environment. This scenario is the governance that Australia will accept in the future. Now, I've gone into the Beverley process in some detail because it shows, I think, how perverted the process of approvals and assessments of nuclear projects is in South Australia. And it provides some indication to you of the likely process for the mooted National Radioactive Waste Dump. And the follow-on, Pangaea and the world's nuclear waste dump proposal. South Australians should be under no illusions as to the way this issue will play itself out, for the precedent is already being set now. By allowing uranium mines at Beverley and Honeymoon with in-situ leaching, mines which are subject to lowest common denominator scrutiny and approvals, the path is laid for a continuing expansion of uranium mining in South Australia, the Lake Frome at Uranium Province, and in Western Australia. Add to this the building of a new nuclear reactor in Sydney's Lucas Heights, producing more radioactive waste, waste incidentally, which though described as intermediate, is considered in other jurisdictions like the US as high-level waste. Add to that the sighting of a national radioactive waste dump in Woomera, which Pangaea had already applied to the Commonwealth to own and operate, then the context of the Pangaea International Dump proposal becomes clear. And may I simply quote to you the words of the Pangaea spokesman when the media said to him, "Well, the government has ruled this out. The government has completely ruled this out. What do you say?" And he said, "Our job is to turn a no into a yes." I don't have time to deal with the health issues that apply with radiation, with the likelihood of the pollution of the gene pool. I don't have time to take you on a quick trawl through uranium mining in Czechoslovakia and the United States and Canada. I don't have time to give you a run through on the kind of effects that radioactivity and radioactive waste has upon people. I don't have time to refer to the issue of Indigenous people's involvement and use of their land. I don't have time to deal with the civil liberties issues. I will note that the Beverley process has been exempted from the Environmental Protection Act. If there was ever a project that needed the Environmental Protection Act to apply, one would have thought it was this, but apparently not. I don't have the opportunity to go into the Department of Energy in the US's forecasts on the amount of resources, on the amount of lawmaking, on the amount of stratification of bureaucracies that's required to in any way address issues of securing amounts of nuclear waste. I don't have time to do that in my address to you today. I don't have time to deal with the other environment issues, apart from noting that the desert's environment is as important as any other environment in our view. It's little understood and it's sensitive. And groundwater has a value. And I don't have time, nor do I have experience or wisdom or knowledge to deal with the social and the cultural issues that will permeate in this state if this course of action continues unabated. A state which rightly celebrates its accomplishments, its distinctive cosmopolitan lifestyle, its civilised, exciting and highly attractive social dimensions. I don't have time to tell you about the trip to Hiroshima, which makes me as passionate about these issues as I am, nor the trip to the Black Mountain Reservation, in Arizona, not far from a uranium mine. But I've been there and I've seen it. And I don't have time, nor do I have the expertise, to stand up here and say seriously what a rigorously independent, authoritative economic and scientific analysis would say about a cost-benefits analysis of issues of this kind. But I'm pretty confident of which way they would run. I'm convinced, ACF is convinced, that the national interest is not well served by embracing the nuclear option. But we need more than that. We need more than conservation organisations carrying the can. At this point, ACF has shouldered the load. We need help. We need your help. We need the help of the community to ask the questions, to have the vigorous debate, not to accept the PR when it arrives on your desk or out of the fax machine. Our democracy depends on it, and the long term, the health of your state will depend on it as well. Thank you.
Peter, I'm Bronwyn Harrell from the Advertiser newspaper. I just wanted to ask you a question. You mentioned in your talk about the business community in many cases getting behind the environment movement, and that's certainly very true. But surely from what you're seeing with the nuclear industry, particularly in South Australia, you're obviously not making inroads with that particular side of things. I wanted to ask you firstly, I mean, how are you going to go about, I mean, are you going around in circles at the moment? Are you going to make any inroads there? Secondly, you might be aware of a couple of court cases which are happening in Adelaide at the moment with an Aboriginal man by the name of Kevin Buzzacott, who's actually trying to get Roxby Downs stopped up there. And so obviously this is a situation that the environment movement is in. Things are obviously well on the way with Jabiluka, Beverley, and to a lesser extent Honeymoon. They're on the way, so it's a matter of if you're going to do anything, you've got to stop them after they've started, which is what Kevin Buzzacott's trying to do. How do you think the movement's going to be able to go about succeeding in doing this?
Well, the conservation organisations have had a consistent position on nuclear matters, uranium mining, radioactive waste and so on for many, many years. That position is well known in the Australian community. It's well known amongst the political parties. And we'll continue to argue that. We'll continue to be active. We'll continue to do the kind of work that I highlighted in my address to you, which I think is very important work in a civil society. But by ourselves, we can't stop this. We can't. And I have to say to you that one has to be able to take a step back and ask oneself really seriously, where is the national interest? Who stands to benefit and who doesn't stand to benefit from these proposals? Now, someone can walk in here from Pangaea or from the Minister's Department and give you an extremely eloquent set of justifications and principles and reasons as to why what they're doing is fine. And I've heard those arguments. Now, I don't accept them. But the more important issue, and this is the issue about the path that South Australia is going down on, is you're being set up. You are being set up as a state. And when you're being set up, you should be aware of it, and you should stand up and you should say, we're not prepared to be set up in this way. Now, I can get up and make that claim that you are, but for you to enact on that on yourself, you'll have to satisfy yourselves as media, as public, as other institutions, as public servants, teachers, whatever people do. They have to be able to satisfy themselves. We will say what we say and we'll continue to do what we do, and presumably the people that want to see this continue will continue to do what they do as well, and people will have an opportunity to make up their minds about whether they want to go down this road or not. But the great difficulty and the great problem, ladies and gentlemen, is simply this. People lead busy lives. Conservation organisations campaign across a range of issues. We are working very hard, for example, on the Murray River, and I think we're playing a productive and cooperative role with people getting the health of the Murray River back. That's in your interests. I'm now coming here and talking about nuclear issues. They are in your community's interests. So I don't see it as being whether, you know, I'm not sort of taking a kind of a media view, and we're sort of keeping a scorecard here on how the Greenies are going against sort of the mining companies. Sorry, it's gone way past that. I mean, any idea at all that there would be talks between a proponent for a national radioactive waste dump facility here, talks that were not reported by the politicians of the day, including Mr. Fisher, who's in this state at this point in time, and that then the government would rule it out, won't rule it out in legislation. This talk is irrelevant. This talk is of no consequence whatsoever until the people of the state and the people of the country decide whether they do want it or that they don't. Then this will continue to happen until the people make the point of view very clear upon it. And that's what this is all about.
Cheryl Nixon from AAP. I've got two questions, if that's all right. The first relates to ERA's quarterly report, which was released today. And in that, they've said a 21-year extension of their lease over the Ranger uranium mine inspired hope of agreement with the same traditional owners at Jabiluka. So I was wondering, first of all, if you could comment on that. And secondly, I've heard said that with the turn of the millennium at the end of this year, if you want to debate that as well, but which I don't think we'll get into, but with the fears over the millennium bug, that perhaps the nuclear industry and in particularly in developing countries, that there might be some fears of nuclear accidents come the end of this year. I wanted to hear whether the ACF had heard reports of that and whether, in fact, they might be true.
Okay. Let me deal with the second part of that question first, accidents and YK2. I never get it right. I don't think there's any doubt that all responsible authorities in all of the governments in the world that I'm aware of that have carriage over nuclear weapons, for example, will make absolutely certain that there's no opportunity for Millennium Bug. The problem, though, is a different kind of problem, as you're probably well aware, and that problem is where, and someone who's more computer literate than I can express this better, so I'll give you my own punter's version. Someone over there wants to ask a question. The problem is simply whether in less developing countries the replacement chip and replacement technologies matches the original technologies which established the program and drives the program. And it may be that in some of these countries they haven't gone through all the necessary compliance procedures in order to satisfy that the matches are actually there. In that case, there's always the remote likelihood that there'll be accidents of different kinds where computers are involved. But I would say that I wouldn't want to, you know, go for a front page on the advertisers. We're all going to blow up in, you know, January the 1st, because I don't think that's true. With ERA, my response to that is very simple. What's happening in Jabiluka is an anomaly. It's an anomaly that was created when the Fox report originally heard evidence about what should happen in Kakadu, because Kakadu is our most important national park. It's the only park in Australia which has got World Heritage recognition for its natural and its cultural value, so it has a continuing living culture of Aboriginal people, but it's got very high conservation values. But the entire North Arnhem region is completely full of uranium and other precious metals. And Justice Fox, recognising that in his report, chose a compromise option, which was to create a park but to allow for some mining within the borders of the park, even though the mines themselves were not considered to be a part of the park. They are smack bang in the middle of it. We believe that mining is incompatible with the values of the park, particularly in the late 20th century. But the agreements that were struck by the traditional owners, by the land councils, by the government, by ERA, and by Justice Fox's suggestion in his report, was that the milling of the ore for the second mine, because Ranger's already there as a mine, and the Jabiluka mine, which is nearby, 26 kilometres or approximately away, that the ore, once it was dug out, would be actually treated and washed down and milled on site. Now, ERA have always wanted to mill that ore back down at Ranger, and the traditional owner must give consent to that. And the pressure that is on the traditional owners to give that consent is great, as it is on Aboriginal people in these situations, despite international concern and national concern about Jabiluka. And the extension of that lease period for another 21 years will play into that pressure. To what extent, I don't know. But I want to make a final comment about Jabiluka and everything that goes with it, because my expectation as president of ACF was that the Liberal Party would seek to advance uranium mining at Jabiluka and Coongara, because it was a part of their policy. We will resume uranium mining. And they made it perfectly clear that it was something that they were going to do. And we have to contest the wisdom and the propriety of that decision in public debate. But what we most strenuously object to is the manner in which that approval and the continuation of that mining has been undertaken. And we believe that the entire Jabiluka experience is a poor reflection upon government, upon the capacity of government to rigorously and scrupulously observe its own guidelines in terms of these approvals, completely leaving outside for a moment the issue of the merits of the mine being there or not. We don't believe it should be there, but that's another matter.
Can see the ABC over there?
Gotta switch it on. I learnt that early on when I hit the stage.
Because you are losing public support generally in the community. And perhaps the second part to that question is it radicalism and so-called eco-nuts that are making people steer clear of the conservation movement?
Do you want to repeat the first part of the question for the other audience here?
I was saying that, just getting back to the what you were saying before about public support, does the ACF accept that it is being pushed to the margins of debate nationally and in this state because it is losing public support, and B, is it because of radicalism and so-called eco-nuts?
We are greatly encouraged by the fact that the majority of the Australian population consistently rates environment as a significant issue for them. It wasn't a significant election issue in the last election, but in the polling, and certainly the deep polling that's been done by most of the reputable polling institutions, it is in there amongst the top 10 of issues that people have concern about. We're also greatly encouraged by the fact that overall membership of conservation organisations, including neighbourhood conservation organisations, land care organisations, Clean Up Australia's, Clean Up Watches and so on and so forth, continues to increase, and that our own membership also is increasing. We're also encouraged by the fact that we do have a substantial body of public opinion support for us in our campaigning, and I can cite you numerous examples where that's the case. I completely reject and think fanciful, that we don't enjoy community support. What we do, though, have is a government that's intent on seeing us marginalised, a government which uses very skillfully its resources and the imprimatur it has as elected government of the day to advance its own issues and its conservation issues, but not the issues that which we think are critical. And I must say to you, there is a huge difference both in the position taken by the federal government, but also the position within states of different state governments. And when a government takes leadership or is prepared to accept or run on an issue, then everything opens up. The discussion opens up, the media takes an interest, and away you go. But if government decides it doesn't want to do that, I'm not crying about that, I'm just pointing it out as a political fact of life, then you have to work that much harder to make yourself heard. Now, let me talk about so-called eco-nuts and people of that sort. I want to completely applaud now the activities and the efforts of young Australians who go out onto blockades, chain themselves to trees, who are doing what they can to stop the destruction of the environment which they care for. I think, to be a little bit cheeky, that the taxpayer of Australia, if any of these people are on the dole, and I'm sure some of them are, is getting an extremely good value for money. This is money very well spent. Let me give you one statistic. The first decent shot with big computers that's been done, I think it's by the Stanford School of Physics, on valuing natural ecosystems worldwide, has come up with a figure of $1.6 trillion of trying to rate a value of ecosystems. Now, I may have these figures slightly wrong, so don't quote me on this, please, press, but I think it's about $1.6 trillion, and GDP is sitting at about $1 trillion. That ought to be the end of the economic discussion, but unfortunately it isn't. There's much more complexities in it than that. The areas that those people have saved, the Daintree Rainforest, the Southeast Forest of New South Wales, the Franklin in Tasmania, these are areas which now provide generated income in perpetuity for the economies of their states. These are areas that now provide employment in perpetuity for the areas that are saved. I mean, it is a, from our perspective, from ACS perspective, it is a strange form of economic rationalism when you cut off your nose to spite your face by driving down the value of your natural areas of beauty, which, if you preserved and maintained them and looked after them, would be able to generate income for you for time immemorial. Now, any person, whether they've got a ring in their nose or a ponytail or a business suit, is welcome in that struggle.
Peter, Andrew Mayall from the ABC. Just one question. We have a global warming problem that you identified before, and one of the things I think had a bit of commonality with that was this Y2K bug. Now, we read in the financial papers now that we have now spent US $1 trillion on that problem in just under 2 years. Why hasn't the environmental movement been able to imbue that sense of urgency into the global warming debate?
The reason that we haven't been able to imbue that sense of urgency in the environment debate is that there is only one country in the world, one developed country in the world, where that sense of urgency is absent, and it's Australia. And that comes about directly as a result of the government's position at Kyoto. And I just want to make one reference here. I made a reference to the geological organisation, and I made the reference to ABARE in passing. Let me just put on the record our profound concerns that ACF has about the way in which the ABARE material was produced and delivered to the government at Kyoto, and the fact that you had to pay $50,000 if you wanted to sit on that ABARE committee. And quite clearly, a conservation organisation or not-for-profit couldn't afford to pay that amount of money to sit on that committee. We are high greenhouse gas emitters on a per capita basis, very high, and we'll be condemned for that, even though we've got a small population. And there are three really important reasons why we should take greenhouse seriously. The first reason is that if we take it seriously, we may improve our own environment in our capital cities. The second reason is that those companies that take it seriously and respond to the challenges of renewables and clean energy will derive economic and market advantage from their competitors that stay in dirty. And the third reason is that in relation to countries on our immediate rim, particularly Asian countries, but particularly China, who quite clearly are going to be an extraordinary potential force for either global green or global not clean, we need to be citizens and neighbours of good example, particularly as we have the industrial, political and infrastructure capacity to do that. Now, we're doing none of that. The reason we're not is that the current federal government is of a mind to listen very clearly to the resource industry's push that comes into the cabinet, and whatever measures they've undertaken on greenhouse, and there have been some, have basically been at the margins, and I think that is a huge regret.
Hi, Annabelle Crabb from The Advertiser. It's back to nuclear waste, I'm afraid. Local supporters for proposals like Pangaea's, and I don't think they're numerous, but they do include people like the scientist Paul Davies, say that if you're going to have to store nuclear waste somewhere, why not do it somewhere that's politically stable, although that's arguable, like South Australia, and in a place that has the resources to contain it safely. Now, how do you respond to that, given the kind of political and social football that nuclear waste has become internationally?
The question that the lady has asked, and I'll finish now because I can see that this afternoon's coming to its close as well, is a very simple one. How do I respond to people, including eminent people and scientific people in the community like Paul Davies and others, that there ought to be a waste site which is politically and geologically stable, and we'd be exercising our responsibility to take care of this intractable problem for other parties in the world? And my answer has got a number of levels to it. I'll be quick with this. With greatest respect to Paul Davies, who obviously is an outstanding scientist, this is very bad science. And with greatest respect to Sir Gustav Nossal and others, it remains bad science. Most of the scientists that are involved in promoting and articulating a reason for this solution are actually employed by the proponents, Pangaea. But Professor Davies is not an ecologist. He does not have an ecological background. He does not understand, I don't think, to any great degree or depth, what the management issues are in terms of radioactive waste. And our position is a simple one. If a country generates nuclear waste, as Australia has generated small amounts, then it is our primary responsibility to ensure that it is safely disposed of. This is the Achilles heel of the nuclear industry, disposal. It has always been the Achilles heel, and it will remain ever thus, even if technological solutions arrive that satisfy it. The technological solutions themselves become highly expensive, highly rigorous, highly imposing. But more important than anything else is until we are satisfied that there is a complete, beyond all realms of reasonable doubt, safe and appropriate method of disposing of any of this waste, even our own, we shouldn't bury it out of sight, out of mind, and we shouldn't put a cork on the bottle and run away from it and expect that the genie won't escape. And that's the flaw in Professor Davies and any other scientific approach to this. For the moment, it is appropriate for nuclear waste to be stored above ground, not buried in trenches in the ground, and discreetly, appropriately, and beyond reasonable doubt, treated over the coming centuries, because it's going to be around for coming centuries. Thank you. Lots of you.
Don't go yet.
One last one, and you may find this a curious question, but and I think I know the answer, but it comes out of something that I was talking to Liz Ho about, the person I was talking to Liz Ho about this morning, and I'd just be interested to hear your response to this. It's April 1945, and you are Harry S. Truman, President of the United States for a matter of days. And the Secretary of State for War comes through the door of the White House and says, Mr. President, you don't know about this. We've just developed this thing called the atomic bomb, and we spent $2 billion American dollars doing it. What do we do with it? What do you do, Mr. President?
I ring the Chief of Staff of the opposing forces, and I explain to him that I'm advised that our scientists have developed this particular weapon, and that evidence of its development, objectively verifiable, can be provided to him. But I don't drop the bomb on an unsuspecting population at 6:45 in the morning who basically weren't involved in that war particularly anyway. I'm talking about the civilian population, that is. More hypotheticals.
Thank you very much indeed. You can't go down yet. You have to have...
you're going to give me a box of wine. Thank you so much.
I don't know what's in it, but I suspect it's sound and pure and absolutely desirable. And we thank you for your eloquent, passionate, and important address.
Thanks, Ray. Thank you. Thank you. Good.